something happened to cause a short in the electrical system that in turn brought down the network.
A blown fuse interrupts network service for large parts of the University of Alaska system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an increase in cases of hepatitis C is costing the state millions.
We need to make sure that that person gets addiction treatment therapy and that they're getting their basic health care needs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The University of Alaska's information technology infrastructure and many of its network systems suffered a prolonged, widespread outage today on at least two campuses. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
For more than 3 hours, depending on the location, phones, internet, external websites, and internal sites like the ones staff use for HR or that students and professors use for classes were down. It all started with contractors on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus working in the Butrovich building on a backup battery system. This is Marmion Grimes, a UAF spokeswoman.
Something happened to cause a short in the electrical system that in turn brought down the network.
The fix required special technicians and a specialized high-voltage replacement part that was apparently not already on hand.
Facility services crews were able to find a fuse in town and get that fuse replaced.
The outage lasted for several hours. Grimes says police and fire dispatchers at the university had no internet, but they were still able to take calls and use radios. But other public safety services tied to the system, including but not limited to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, were also affected. The center tweeted that some automated earthquake information was unavailable, for example. Grimes, with UAF, says there did not appear to be any far-reaching threat to public safety. The University of Alaska, and actually this network, had some difficulties related to the outage. There were persisting problems this evening for dozens of Alaska community stations and translators that are part of Alaska Public Television and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Steve Hamlin, the technical manager for Alaska Public Broadcasting, said at about 3 p.m. that various systems needed to distribute programming were starting to come back online.
So it's sort of like having to reboot and restart stuff and get all the different traffic signs going the right way.
UAF said late this afternoon that its systems downstream from the outage continue to come back online as well. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Casey Grove.
Like much of the country, Alaska is seeing a surge in opioid and heroin addiction, and state officials are scrambling to deal with the consequences. One side effect is a big increase in diseases connected to injecting drugs, particularly hepatitis C. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, this is raising concerns about a potential tidal wave of healthcare costs.
Jay Butler's Midtown office has a framed picture of a Yupik mask painted in hot, bright colors, representing a face in pain from hepatitis C.
That's certainly how I interpret it.
Butler is chief medical officer for the state health department, and the piece is fitting because right now, worries about hep C, a virus that slowly destroys the liver, is keeping him awake at night.
We talk mostly about opioid overdose deaths, but there's a lot more that happens related to opioid use than just deaths.
Like hepatitis C infections. As more people inject prescription painkillers and heroin, there's a parallel rise in blood-borne diseases, especially among young people.
The most concerning trend that we see is an increasing number of diagnoses among people age 18 to 29.
That's new. Hep C used to hit baby boomers the hardest. The virus wasn't discovered until 1991, and by then, millions had been exposed to it through blood transfusions, tattoo needles, and syringes. Rates fell throughout the 90s and bottomed out in the 2000s, but since then, the number of cases is shooting up. Infections among 18 to 29-year-olds have doubled in a 5-year period. Chronic hep C is not a death sentence, but it creates a pile of long-term problems, so it is a public health nightmare.
About 1 in 5 people will develop more progressive liver damage, with fibrosis, meaning scarring of the liver, and cirrhosis, where the scarring is getting to the point where the liver does not function very well.
Until recently, the treatment available for the Hep C virus was ineffective and fairly toxic. But in 2013, the FDA approved a new class of drugs called direct-acting antivirals, which can clear the body of Hep C 90% of the time. But here's the catch. They are extremely expensive.
The price is the downside, and why I usually don't say it's a miracle drug, because miracles don't come with a price. They're gifts.
A course of treatment can cost $90,000. Butler once did a back-of-the-envelope calculation of what it would cost to treat the roughly 3.5 million Americans estimated to be infected with Hep C.
I was coming up with more than 10% of the entire cost of all medical care in the country.
In other words, not feasible. It's especially troubling for a state like Alaska. In rural areas, people don't have as much access to clean needles, and so tend to reuse and share them more than in urban areas, leading to more infections. And while Hep C medications are expensive on the front end, they're actually cheaper in the long term than treating people's liver damage or paying for transplants. And that's putting real stress on a prime source of care, Medicaid.
We've seen definitely an increase in the number of individuals who've accessed these medications.
Erin Naris is the lead pharmacist for the state's Medicaid program. As patients and doctors have grown more familiar with the new Hep C meds, they're being prescribed more. In 2015, Alaska's Medicaid program spent about $6 million on Hep C treatments. The next year, that more than doubled. And that money only bought treatment for about 150 people. Nationwide, Medicaid spent about $2.2 billion on just one Hep C medicine made by a company called Gilead Science, more than any other single medication.
It appears as if that outpaced the other drugs in that year.
Medicaid is just one of the insurers paying for these medications. Numbers from private providers, the VA, and the Indian Health Service are not public. One study by the McDowell Group calculated that treating the 1,000 people in Alaska estimated to be infected with Hep C from injecting drugs in 2015 would cost $90 million. And even that model probably lowballs the number of cases. The areas seeing the steepest growth rates in Hep C infections are Southwest, Northern, and Southeast Alaska, rural communities where healthcare, access to clean needles, and testing are spread the most thin. Among young people in Southeast, the rate of diagnosis went up 490% during 5 years. Most of the officials interviewed think when it comes to hepatitis C in Alaska, the reality is likely much worse than what the data show, which is bad because right now the state has no money. Democrat Ivy Sponholz represents East Anchorage in the legislature and chairs the House's Health and Social Services Committee.
This is not a time when it is likely that we'll be able to increase the amount of money being allocated to addiction treatment.
Sponholz says without more funding for rehab programs or social services, legislators have been focusing on prevention efforts, like limiting access to pain pills. Governor Bill Walker also expanded Medicaid 2.5 years ago under the Affordable Care Act, and lawmakers are now hoping to tweak how the state delivers behavioral health care. Sponholz says the state recently requested something called an 1115 waiver, which could give the state more discretion from the federal government when it comes to what treatments Medicaid can pay for.
We need to make sure that that person gets addiction treatment therapy and that they're getting their basic health care needs met. So we need a lot more flexibility to be creative with that. The 1115 Medicaid waivers could allow us to do that.
Right now, the U.S. Senate is debating a Republican bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, which could undermine this approach. It might end the requirement that private health insurance cover mental health benefits, leaving people without access to addiction treatment. More dramatically, it would make deep cuts to federal Medicaid spending compared to the current law and change the open-ended structure to one with fixed budgets, which means states like Alaska will be forced to make more painful choices about whether they can afford the expensive treatments for growing problems like hepatitis C. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Tomorrow night on Alaska News Nightly, we'll bring you the second part of this story, Alaskans working to reduce transmission among injection drug users. It's at a syringe exchange that's seen its volume double in just 2 years to around 500,000 needles. Last night, the Anchorage Assembly approved a measure that gives immunity to sex workers who tell police when more serious crimes have occurred. When the ordinance was first introduced, it drew support from advocates as well as several women who had previously engaged in prostitution. Many testified they'd encountered heinous and violent crime, but were afraid of reporting it to law enforcement for fear of prosecution. However, critics say the proposal was vague, hard to enforce, and targeted a problem it's not clear happens often in Anchorage. Even after revisions, the municipal prosecutor's office remained firmly opposed. But assembly members like Eric Croft of West Anchorage felt the reworked ordinance was narrow enough to potentially boost reporting to law enforcement without many negative impacts.
And it's not doing very much harm because there really aren't, again, that many prosecutions for this.
Under municipal statute, prostitution is a Class B misdemeanor. The new measure specifies a person who witnesses or is victim to some Class A misdemeanors can receive immunity if he or she cooperates in reporting it to police. The move is aligned with a similar provision in SB 91, last year's state omnibus crime bill. The ordinance passed 10-1, with Eagle River Representative Amy Demboski opposed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new state law replaces Columbus Day with a holiday honoring Indigenous peoples.
This is meant to be something that's inclusive, and this is something to really promote Native culture throughout our state and recognize the amazing impact of our first people.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
University of Alaska researchers are planning new strategies to address suicide in Alaska Native communities. A more than $4 million federal grant is funding creation of a clearinghouse of successful strategies drawn from villages and regions across the state. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
The Alaska Native Epidemiology Center says between 2003 and 2015, one in seven Alaska Native high school students attempted suicide. And suicide is the leading cause of death for Alaska Native male teens. Dr. Lisa Wexler has been addressing these and other mental health issues in the Alaska Northwest for more than two decades. She says it's important to realize those statistics are relatively new.
There were very few documented Indigenous youth suicide cases. And it really came about as there was rapid change, as there was a new generation of kids that were sort of disempowered.
Wexler is one of the principal investigators of a $4.25 million grant from the National Institute of Mental Health. She says the grant, in part, funds a broad social approach to suicide research.
So if we think about it as a social problem, that allows us to really conceptualize policy solutions, that allows us to conceptualize community-level solutions that we maybe haven't been thinking about as well or as much as we might.
Wexler says the grant will also create a hub at the College of Rural and Community Development at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Dr. Stacy Rasmus at UAF is another of the principal investigators. The hub, she says, will serve as a clearinghouse of sorts of proven Alaska Native-based community strategies. Data is available from other parts of the country about suicide prevention, she says, but sometimes the contexts don't fit.
Trying to adapt them to fit within a village context or to serve in these widely diverse geographic and cultural communities, they just don't work.
Rasmus says she and her colleagues will develop a tool that is user-friendly and practical so both rural and urban communities can access approaches that work.
So we have a study that will involve 65 communities in three regions to see, you know, if we can create that tool for communities to identify how exactly culture is prevention.
Rasmus says she and her colleagues are already meeting to put the five-year grant to work. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Nome residents could soon be able to buy locally grown vegetables from Pilgrim Hot Springs at a market stand in town. Thanks to the Pilgrim Produce Program, which receives some funding from a USDA grant, various crops are currently being grown at Pilgrim Hot Springs, an Unakduk land. Unakduk is a consortium of organizations and Native corporations such as White Mountain and Mary's Igloo that has partnered with groups like the Bering Straits Development Company. Robert Benson is the construction manager with BSDC.
The stable ones are definitely the potatoes and the onions, and we're definitely gone real big. If we get to what the average yield is per plant for the potatoes, we're probably looking at, you know, a few thousand pounds. And as with the onions, there's definitely a few thousand onions already in the ground that are doing very well.
Benson is one of the few people who is regularly found at Pilgrim with his boots on the ground and hands in the dirt. He explains why it's beneficial to have the option to buy locally grown produce.
Well, it's organic, so GMO-free, no pesticides, no fertilizers. Well, no bad fertilizers, obviously, you know, compost. And it will be competitive with the local markets here in town.
Other plants growing at Pilgrim include celery, squash, pumpkins. Benson says it's hard to say what the yield will be at this point in the season. Last summer in 2016, the test garden that produced a crop harvest from a one-acre plot of land received a dusting of snow during the first week of September, forcing the team to end their growing season. This summer, Benson says they started growing earlier than last year, but how much time they have to grow is uncertain.
It's really just a, you know, keep an eye on the weather and keeping an eye on the road conditions as well, because that dictates when you get in and out of there for the end of the season.
Overall, there have been many challenges to maintaining a growing farm next to the hot springs, such as voles snacking on the crops, beavers damming up culverts, which blocks water flow, and accessing the site on a regular basis. Benson suggests that transporting the plants to and from Pilgrim is most difficult.
It's the logistics. It's, you know, starting the starts here in town and then having to transport them out there, you know, and then still you have to see what it's going to take to get them back once we harvest, what it's going to take to get everything back here to market.
Pilgrim Produce hopes to have a weekly farmers market stand within Nome city limits starting up on Saturdays sometime this summer. Efforts to unseat longtime Sea Alaska incumbents failed this year. The board slate won the Southeast Regional Native Corporation elections, and a measure targeting those incumbents failed to attract enough votes to pass. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea Alaska's 22,000 shareholders have been able to vote by mail in the web since early May. Results were released during the corporation's June 24th annual meeting held in Heidelberg on Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. Eight independent candidates entered the race, many of them critical of the corporation's leaders. But the four seats on the ballot were won by a management slate made up of three incumbents and an allied newcomer. The top vote-getter was Heidelberg's Sidney Edenshaw. He's a 12-year board member and president of his community's tribal association. Next was Kingston, Washington's Ed Thomas. The 27-year board member spent most of the past three decades as president of the regional tribal government, the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The third winning incumbent was Juneau's Ross Sobolev. The writer and commercial fisherman won a board seat 3 years ago as part of an independent slate. Kirkland, Washington's Morgan Howard was also elected. The communications company owner was chosen by the board from a group of about 50 shareholders who applied to run on its slate. He filled a seat vacated by Juneau anthropologist Rosita Worrell. The 30-year board member did not seek re-election this year, though she continues to run the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, the corporation's cultural arm. Eight independent candidates also ran for Sea Alaska's board of directors. The highest vote-getters were Karen Togg and Doug Chilton of Juneau and Nicole Hollingstad of Arlington, Virginia. Togg works in finance, Chilton is an artist and teacher, and Hollingstad works for the National Congress of American Indians. She used to be Sea Alaska's corporate secretary. Candidate Togg authored the measure, targeting longtime incumbents. It would have shrunk the 13-member panel to 9 over several years, which she said would save money and promote efficiency. It called for prohibiting members with the most seniority from running on a board-endorsed slate. That would have made it much harder to win re-election. The measure attracted more support than opposition, but with a fewer than 60% turnout, it fell far short of the required majority of all votes that could have been cast. Sea Alaska opposed the measure, saying it would reduce representation and remove board members with valuable experience. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag careers begin here to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
In southeast Alaska, populations of some marine mammals like humpback whales and stellar sea lions are on the rise. Some subgroups of these species have recently been removed from the endangered species list, leaving many commercial fishermen wondering what this means for them. But as KFSK reporter Nora Sachs found out, it's still business as usual when it comes to dealing with protected marine mammals in southeast waters.
In early June, NOAA Fisheries representatives held a virtual community roundtable in Petersburg to update fishermen and the public on marine mammal policies and clear up any confusion. Alaria Jensen is the deputy of Alaska's Protected Resources Division for the agency. She was visiting via Google Hangout.
One of the questions I know has been on people's minds is this pretty monumental change that happened last year for humpback whales.
Three different groups of humpbacks migrate to coastal Alaska. Last September, one was delisted, one was reclassified as threatened, and one from the western North Pacific remains endangered. It's a similar story with stellar sea lions. Two populations can be found in the area. One is endangered, and one isn't. Since it's impossible to tell these genetically distinct populations apart by sight, Jensen said they all have to be treated the same and afforded full protection under the Endangered Species Act.
So for you, essentially, that means business as usual. That's really the status quo of how we've been operating. Nothing is changing in terms of, you know, a vessel's behavior around a whale.
Sea lions can steal salmon from commercial nets or become a harbor nuisance, while whales can get tangled in nets and crab gear. There are devices like noisemakers, visual repellents, and exclusion barriers on the market intended to keep these animals away. But there's currently no list of agency-approved or prohibited deterrence methods to guide fishermen, which means there isn't a clear answer to the million-dollar question of whether or not fishermen can use deterrence to protect their gear and catch, or which ones. It's a situation which seemed to frustrate NOAA Fisheries staff as much as fishermen. Alaria Jensen again.
We want to be able to help you avoid violations. We want a win-win. Nobody wants whales and gear in the same place. We have really looked to our national program to provide that guidance, and it certainly has been long in coming.
A draft list is in the works and should come out sometime next year. Even when the list is finalized, likely in 2019, it will only address the impact of each deterrent on marine mammals, not its effectiveness. And while the Marine Mammal Protection Act allows fishermen to use deterrents to protect their property as long as no animals are hurt, the Endangered Species Act does not contain the same explicit exemption. While NOAA officials wait for better standards and clearer regulations, Jensen said right now they need the fishing industry's help to come up with creative solutions. Gill netter Max Warhatch said he hasn't seen very many humpbacks so far this year, but when he does...
I got aluminum boats, so I just take a stick and beat on the boat when I get close to the boat, and then it kind of, I think... Humpbacks don't use echolocation, they just use their ears and their eyes, so it kind of makes them aware, and I've had minimal incidents with whales, so it seems like it works for me.
For now, NOAA Fisheries representatives recommend avoiding marine mammals as much as possible, and not doing anything that could cause more interactions, like dumping fish waste near boats. In Petersburg, I'm Nora Sachs.
In Utqiagvik over the weekend, Governor Bill Walker signed legislation recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day in Alaska. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports the law establishes Alaska as the second state in the nation to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday of October, replacing Columbus Day.
Governor Walker said on Saturday, quote, "This official recognition is just one way we as a state can acknowledge and celebrate the contributions made by First Peoples throughout the history of this land." For the past 2 years, the governor had, quote, "issued one-year observances for the second Monday in October to be Indigenous Peoples Day." The signing of the new law will complete that effort, and Alaska will join South Dakota in recognizing that holiday. Representative Dean Westlake of Kotzebue, Senator Donnie Olson of Nome, and Representative Zach Fansler of Bethel were in attendance for the signing, along with a number of representatives from the North Slope Borough. That's according to Representative Fansler, who is also the first co-signer for House Bill 78, put forward by the representative from Kotzebue.
At one point, we were actually thinking about trying to carry this bill. Representative Westlake ended up carrying it, and we co-signed right away.
The signing was held during Barrow's annual Nalukatuk Whaling Festival.
They take the whales, they've been fermenting them, they'd kind of harvested them back in April, and this is where they divvy up the whale parts to literally the entire community.
The Inupiaq tradition is a day-long festival where much of the town came out to celebrate a successful whale hunt, says Fansler. Different parts of fermented whale are brought out with cakes and candy, followed by singing, a blanket toss, and then dancing. Fansler says it was an appropriate occasion for the bill signing.
People were already super enthusiastic, and then when you coupled that with the idea that we were signing into law something that establishes the second Monday as Indigenous Peoples Day, you know, that just made it all the better.
The crowd and legislators were happy to see the bill finally come to fruition, says Fansler, as there have been several attempts over the years to pass similar legislation.
On the Senate side, on the House side. So I think there has been this push for some time, and for various reasons, sometimes it just doesn't move along. But this year was a year where I think we had a historic legislature.
Fansler says that for a number of reasons, one being that Alaska is finally seeing its first Speaker of the House who is an Alaska native.
This is meant to be something that's inclusive, and this is something to really promote Native culture throughout our state and recognize the amazing impact of our First People.
Representative Fansler says he's looking forward to celebrating October 9th as Alaska's first official Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Christine Trudeau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Nora Sachs in Petersburg, Davis Hovey in Nome, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, and Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska initiative, designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August the 1st. Learn more at finishcollege.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.